The Bill Myers Show podcast is sponsored by Clouser Drilling. They've been leading the way in Southern Oregon well drilling for over 50 years. Find out more about them at clouserdrilling.com.
Here's Bill Meyer.
Good morning and welcome to Monday, September 30th. Hope you are doing well this morning. Join the conversation at 770-563-3770-KMED. I'm going to tell you who we are going to be talking to this morning. And, by the way, Facebook Live is down at the moment. They're having some problems with the Wi-Fi, this network, and so we're going to get that repaired. I don't know if I can do it this morning while I'm on the air because I got to concentrate on doing a show. But if I had to do without just a stream on KMED.com, okay? But coming up today, we're going to talk with a fellow, Dr. Jonathan Newman, fellow at the Newman, make that the Mises Institute, and a nonprofit organization helping to promote and teach research in the Austrian School of Economics. And what Mises is trying to do is take back economics education from essentially the idiots that are running the country and the world economic situation. That's kind of what they're trying to do, getting people to understand some common sense and some common principles. And one of the ways they do that is that you put out a textbook that actually has sense rather than nonsense that tends to be taught a lot in the schools, and they're actually helping to get this into the schools. We'll talk with Dr. Newman about that after the 6:30 news. Johan Pietila is running as judge of the Circuit Court, 1st District, Position 11 here in Jackson County. And I'm looking forward to talking with him. I was surprised that, that Governor Kotek ended up appointing someone of her choosing just a little while ago, who is going to be Johan Pietila's opponent. The current Judge Rowan just got put in like at the very last second. Now, if you know me, and I do, I absolutely despise gubernatorial appointments bypassing or trying to bypass the judicial and electoral process. I'm a big fan of elected judges. And I don't usually look at the appointment of a governor, especially a Democratic governor, hardcore Democratic governor, as necessarily a ringing endorsement. So I asked Johan to come in. We'll talk about it, and we'll kick around what's important. Johan is a senior assistant Jackson County Council, and he is was also a Jackson County Deputy District Attorney. So he's kind of worked for the county in a couple of different capacities. But anyway, we'll have a pretty good conversation. And yet I also have to say that interviewing judicial candidates are sometimes frustrating for me, but maybe it won't be. Maybe he won't make it so frustrating, because you can't ask a question of a judicial a candidate like, okay, how would you have ruled on this case? Because you can't do that. It's absolutely against all the rules. But we'll try to tease our way through what we can talk about, all right? It's 16 minutes after 6. Dr. Dennis Powers will also be joining me, and we'll do Where Past Meets Present, talk a little bit about politics this morning, and kind of the world condition, as it were. All right. John Kerry was speaking last week, just a few days ago. You know, they had the United Nations getting all together, planning the future of the world. All that kind of stuff. The World Economic Forum was also there, too. They were all hanging out in their shrimp fest. And it's really interesting when you have super big elites in the United States of America telling the truth, just absolutely telling the truth about what is about what they're really thinking. And how John Kerry, yes, you know him, former Secretary of State, kind of puffed up. But one of the biggest challenges that the system is having is that we don't believe them like we once did. And there's that pesky thing called the First Amendment. I think it's really worth hearing what some of the elite think of us.
I think the dislike of and anguish over social media is just growing and growing and growing. And it's part of our problem, particularly in democracies, in terms of building consensus around any issue. It's really hard to govern today. You can't, there's no, the referees we used to have to determine what's a fact and what isn't a fact have kind of, been eviscerated to a certain degree. And people go, and that people self-select where they go for their news or for their information. And then you just get into a vicious cycle. So it's really, really hard, much harder to build consensus today than at any time in the 45, 50 years I've been involved in this. And you know, there's a lot of discussion now about how you curb those entities in order to guarantee that you're going to have, you know, some accountability on facts, et cetera. But look, if people go to only one source and the source they go to is sick and, you know, has an agenda and they're putting out disinformation, our First Amendment stands as a major block to the ability to be able to just, you know, hammer it out of existence. So what you need, what we need is to win the ground, win the right to govern by hopefully having, you know, winning enough votes that you're free to be able to implement change. Now, obviously, there are some people in our country who are prepared to implement change in other ways. And
so
that's
you're
really
questioning
dangerous.
Really if democracy can survive unregulated social media.
I think democracies are very challenged right now and have not proven they can move fast enough or big enough to deal with the challenges that we are facing. And to me, that is part of what this race, this election is all about. Will we break the fever in the United States?
Will we break the fever of the United States? Will we break the fever? In other words, will we break the back of the First Amendment? That's really what former Secretary of State John Kerry was saying there. And he said, boy, you know, the problem is with social media is that people just don't believe us. John, why do you think that many people are not believing the system? The rules-based order that, of course, you and Clinton and everybody's been involved with for a long, long time. Why is it, do you think, that there's not as much faith in what you're saying? Could it be that truth doesn't need censoring? Truth rings true to people. And as soon as the government decided to start censoring everything which disagreed with it, people realized, hey, wait a minute. In fact, in some ways, you made us disbelieve it even more. I think a lot of it, the beginning of this, was COVID. Would you agree with me? The intense censoring of everything about COVID, anything which disagreed with Fauci, anything which disagreed with the administration, with the health pumas, alternative treatments. Everybody decided you were just going to shut up, shut your business down, shut your school down, and do what we say. And take the mRNA vaccine. And by the way, if the mRNA vaccine hurt you, well, something else hurt you. It's never the mRNA vaccine. In fact, it's never a vaccine at all. Isn't it great how we, the rules-based order of the United States of America, decided to pass a law that forbid anybody suing the pharmaceutical companies over this? So we'll force you to take it. And then we'll say, no, if it hurts you, too bad, so sad. Maybe a few years from now, our so-called vaccine court, ha, 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 will be just fine. Oh, those other doctors, America's Frontline Doctors, FLCCC.net, the ones that came up with different protocols for handling COVID, for preventing COVID, for strengthening the immune system, ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine, massive doses of vitamin D, vitamin C, and various other situations like that, all that kind of stuff. Those people are conspiracy theorists. Besides, remember, Big Pharma has to be paid. Big Pharma has to be paid because not only is it one of the biggest contributors to the advertising revenues of radio and television networks, it's also one of the biggest contributors to political campaigns. So, yeah, when you're going after the First Amendment, we get a little sensitive about that. So, yeah, when you put a strong arm on social media, people who are having a difference of opinion, we're wanting to look at those differences of opinion. In fact, in some ways, you make us want to look at it anymore. Gee, why are you working so hard to squelch what you call are lies? Because if they really are lies, we can figure that out for ourselves. We are Americans, after all. Yeah. When John Kerry talks about this election, let me see if I can play that that last part of his little conversation here at the World Economic Forum Shrimp Fest.
I think democracies are very challenged right now and have not proven they can move fast enough or big enough to deal with the challenges that we are facing. And to me, that is part of what this race, this election is all about. Will we break the fever in the United States?
Will we break the fever? In other words, will we break the back of people who dare to disagree with their rules-based order? That's really what John Kerry's talking about. Will we bend the knee to the censorship? That's why there's been such an attack on the United States of America. We're one of the last places that still has much of a modicum of that independence of thought yet. And by the way, independence of thought doesn't mean you're always right, too. But if there's one thing that COVID in the last 6, 7, 8 years has taught us, is that everything is about you do what they say. Just trust us. We have white coats. Trust us. We're politicians. That's done. That's over right now. And this is a desperate attempt to claw this back. And the only way they can claw it back is to break us. Is to get us fighting among ourselves. In fact, they've been very successful on the left, getting people all hot and bothered with hate speech, or you're making me feel uncomfortable. Well, speech can be uncomfortable. Exchange of ideas can be uncomfortable. But that's what keeps us safe, if you want to call it that, safe from the bloodthirsty people like John Kerry, who wants you thinking only what he thinks.
We're going to be the arbiter of facts. As we know, we're the same people that told you safe and effective.
Have we forgotten all that? But all's forgiven now, we're just supposed to all forget it now? You closed our schools. You declared some of our jobs, many of our jobs were no longer necessary. Remember that? All that kind of stuff? Speaking of the jobs necessary and that that fight against free speech, Heather MacDonald, I think she's a fellow over at the Manhattan Institute. I've been reaching out to her. I think she's an amazing thinker. She had an amazing statement released the other day. I think American Freedom Alliance ended up putting this out on X. And it had to do with what drove a lot of the COVID insanity. Check this out. I thought it was pretty interesting.
What COVID was the very embodiment of the female worldview, which is unable to balance risks and benefits. It is unable to think soundly about economic matters. It believed that you could substitute a government check for a private enterprise, that the government had the capacity to make judgments about what's an essential business and what's not an essential business. Ask a worker. Is your business essential? Yes, it's right. Essential. Ask a consumer. Right. A belief that we were not adequately comparing the risk of COVID to heart disease and cancer. We still, COVID deaths did not even come close to those deaths, which we take for granted. So I just felt like, right, in March, we already knew everything that needed to be known about COVID. We had the mortality data from Italy.
Yes.
They found that the average age of decedents was 80 with 3 comorbidities. Nothing changed. And yet we pretended that this was a disease that put young people at risk.
Because you had to pretend that it put young people at risk because that was the only way that you could shut people down. Get people into that so-called Great Reset, Green New Deal. Get us thinking about that. And also, pharma had to be paid. Remember? Big pharma got to be paid. by the people that got elected in Washington, D.C. Pharma had to be paid. I think that's all a part of it. But I do think that that Heather MacDonald, being a strong woman, said that it was the female point of view that had a lot to do with what happened. And the inability to judge cost versus benefit on these kind of dangerous issues. That's a pretty spicy thing for her to say that as a female herself there. But I would say, I would dare say, I would blame the men, though. I would blame the men that fell prey to the hysteria myself. What about you? This is the Bill Myers Show, and you're on KMED and 99.3 KBXG.
Home and business.
6.7 KMED.
So, interesting couple of comments over the weekend. John Kerry saying that, you know, the First Amendment is a real problem. You pesky Americans aren't willing to just sit down, shut up, and take the direction from your betters in the World Economic Forum and the rules-based order. And then you have Heather MacDonald saying that, yeah, one of the reasons why people bent the knee on COVID was the female worldview. Female worldview unable to really balance the risks versus rewards. You know, those kind of things. Not really able to handle it. Now, in other words, that's the safetyism. Safetyism. Not all women like that, though, but that is, generally speaking, the predominantly proper view that she was talking about. And, of course, men just ended up kowtowing. Men ended up kowtowing to it. Oh yeah, we got to shut everything down. And it's kind of like, well, you know, the kids cried. You know, the two kids like, you know, David Hogg and things like that. So you have to get rid of the Constitution because of school shootings. Time to shred the Constitution. Yeah, we're going to have to be made from firmer stuff over the sterner stuff over the next few years if we're going to be able to survive a lot of the safetyism that we have been enduring. That's for sure. 770-5633. Good morning. Hi, who's this? Welcome.
Hey, Bill, it's Matt.
Hey, Matt. How are you doing this morning?
Good. I want to start off by saying your opening statement is the reason I started listening to you and continue to listen to you.
Hey, could you hit that phone again or change it? You're cutting out a little bit, Matt.
Yeah, let me try to move a little bit here.
There we go. That's better.
Does that help?
Okay. Yeah, it does.
I just wanted to say that opening statement you gave is the reason I started listening to you such a long time ago and continue to listen. I figured you would probably hit on it sometime today, but I'm glad that you hit on Kerry's comment. I just want to remind everybody that Barack Obama said this, I believe it was when Trump was president, that he was lamenting the days of only three news networks. And for these very reasons, because it was easy to control the message. And I also want to add that the reason that they hate all these other sources of information is because they know that it only takes a few minutes either to convince people that what they're saying is wrong, mm-hmm. or it at least opens the door to curiosity. And then that's when people get online and begin to do their own research. And they hear people like Heather MacDonald, and they say, well, wait a minute, maybe there's something else going on here.
And I remember myself, and I remember, let's even go back with COVID, what she was talking about. I think we were all terrified right in the very beginning. You know, the story that was told of us, that was told to us. You remember that all, don't you, Matt?
I agree. And, you know, it's interesting. I was actually listening to Lars one day, and I remember he was talking about shutting down the schools, and he was on board with all the shutdowns and everything else. And all I could think of was, what happened to this guy? And then, you know, he would explain that he had diabetes and there were other issues and things that, you know, he was concerned. And look, not that I'm someone anybody should listen to in regards to forgiveness, but I forgave a lot of that stuff because people didn't know. People I really cared about went in and got vaccinated as soon as that was available. And looking back on it now, of course, 2020, we realized that they lied. I remember watching, there were some hearings over in Europe, and somebody was asking the Pfizer representative if they did any testing on pregnant women. And, you know, she hemmed and hawed a little bit at first, and then she admitted. She goes, no, we didn't do any testing on pregnant women.
No.
Or women who were lactating.
But yet they were advising women to go in and get it, right?
It's shocking. And, you know, it was also shocking to watch local news and seeing people lining up out of a parking lot with their kids to get the vaccination sitting in their cars. you know, and getting tested and all these other things. And I look at all this and I think to myself, how do you not learn anything? How do you get stuck on a fact? And then as the details change, you don't change with them. And I just think that when I listen to John Kerry talk and I think about everything in that guy's past and his relationship with us, the people, I can't believe anyone would listen to two words coming out of his mouth. I'm glad that you did and that you shared it with people who may not have heard it, because people need to hear these things and then say to themselves, you know, what kind of a country do I want for my kids and my grandkids? Do I want one where Walter Cronkite saying that's the way it is, and then we just have to accept that's the way it is from Walter Cronkite?
In this particular case, we have to accept the guy that who's the guy on ABC that I guess he's the number one guy, World News Tonight.
Oh, the fact checker.
Yeah, David. What's his name now? I don't watch it. You know, I don't watch. I just can't
me
watch
either.
That. Yeah. But, yeah, the fact checker, right? The fact checker who was wrong about so many things. And, oh, this is not true, you know, about the animals and the cats and things like that. Yeah, it is if you actually send a few reporters there that ask a few questions, but neither here nor there. We're here to tell you what the truth is, right? That kind of thing.
You made a great comment. You said that we're American. We're smart. We can do our own research. We can figure things out. I've made this comment. I read, like you, I don't know if it's hundreds of stories every day, it's hundreds of headlines, and then maybe, you know, 40 or 50 stories every day to get my own research, and I don't trust this one source. And that's how I develop my opinions about things. I never watch the news for a half hour and say, oh, well, that's what's going on in the world, and these are the things that I should believe. Never would I do that.
It would be the starting point, really. Right?
That's right.
Okay.
Yep.
And nothing wrong with watching them, but it's just like, okay, what don't they want you to look too deeply at? And then start looking for that. All right.
You know what's interesting, Bill? When it comes to investing, this is one of the things I've told people for decades, and I'll leave you with this.
Sure.
When you read a press release, a quarterly press release, and a company's, you know, releasing its earnings and all that, when you start reading it, look at what they don't say first. Don't just look at what they say first. What don't they say first? Mm-hmm. And it's the same with every news story that breaks. But anyway, thank you so much for playing all those comments from John Kerry, because people need to hear that.
Yeah. Thank you very much. And thank you for being here, Matt. Be well. It's 6:38. Latest news brought to you by locally owned and operated Artisan Bakery.
We're hearing the Bill Myers Show on 106.3 KMED.
Dr. Jonathan Newman is a fellow and big gun, in honor of the bumper music here. He's a big gun fellow at the Mises Institute, a nonprofit organization existing to promote teaching and research in the Austrian School of Economics. Individual freedom, honest history, international peace. Oh, boy. You must be pretty lonely over there, Jonathan. How you doing? Well, welcome to the show. Welcome.
Hey,
it's good
for
to
having me on.
Okay, I'm just teasing. You know what I'm getting at? It just seems that the worldview of the Mises Institution seems to be a bit out of step with what the current so-called rules-based order seems to be all about. Would that be a fair assessment?
That is pretty fair. We have been very principled and consistent throughout the years, ever since the Institute was founded in the 1980s. You mentioned our mission is about, you know, global peace. We want free markets. We want free people. And what that means is, you know, times change, people's ideas change, but we've always been consistent with that message. Probably the main thing that we want to teach here at the Mises Institute is Austrian economics. We want to teach people a way to think about the economy and think about cause and effect with prices and the profit and loss mechanism in a way that leads them to the appropriate conclusions, which is that government usually gets in the way.
Yeah. Well, I can't help but notice that both the Republican Trump and Democrat Harris seem to be out doing a lot of populist talk right now, because at this point, the first job is you got to get elected, right? And so a lot of things get said that I'm kind of scratching my head economically on. And, you know, now I know that practically everything coming out of Kamala's mouth has been pretty much nonsense, because she's been pretty much that way most of her career. But, you know, there are things that I would hear, that I even hear President Trump would say, really, you want to go there? He's talking about limiting interest rates on credit cards to 10%. And I'm thinking to myself, yeah, that sounds really nice if you want to get yourself in a lot of debt. But, you know, as soon as you start putting price controls on anything, whether it's groceries or credit, price controls just mean that you're going to have less credit available. Isn't that the case? Wouldn't that be one of the main points coming out of the Mises Institute on something like this?
You're exactly right. Price controls have sort of the same effects whenever they're implemented. And so if you put a price control on credit, then you're exactly right. You would get a shortage. You would get a lot of people demanding credit at that low interest rate, but not a lot of people supplying credit at that low interest rate, you know, assuming that it is a binding price ceiling. So, it would have terrible effects. But we've come to expect this. Of course, you've probably come to expect this as well. In political campaigns, presidents, you know, nearing the general election, they'll start to, you know, moderate their views. They'll start to, you know, spout out all of these sorts of promises to the populations that we'll give you this, we'll give you that.
Yeah.
Pretty much anything that will sound good to listeners, to potential voters.
But, you know, that almost says more about the American people, I think, at this point in time when it comes to their economic knowledge than it does to maybe the candidates. The candidates are just looking, okay, we got to find a way to persuade. I don't know if they're going to be like John Kerry, quite as cynical as persuade the rubes that everything we're saying is right. But I don't know. How do you see that?
I think you're exactly right, and that's one of the things that we try to focus on here at the Mises Institute. We have this textbook called Lessons for the Young Economist that is very popular among homeschoolers, and it was written a few years ago, but what we're trying to do now is we're making some lecture videos, some videos and other supplementary materials to go along with it to make it even more attractive. In this textbook, it was written by Dr. Bob Murphy, an excellent Austrian economist, and it goes through how to think about the economy. It goes through how to think about things like price controls. It goes through how to think about the profit and loss mechanism. What is inflation? How do we define it? And what are the effects of inflation? And so what that means is if students learn these principles, if they learn, you know, the correct way to think about the economy in a way that they understand cause and effect, it means that they would be immune to these sorts of presidential candidate promises. They would hear a candidate promise, we're going to put a price cap on this. And if students have learned these economic principles, they would understand, hey, this has drawbacks, this has unintended consequences, this is not just a free gift to me. And so that's really what we want to do, is we want to equip students and homeschool families, and really anybody who wants to learn about Austrian economics, really anybody can use these materials. We want them to be able to think about the economy in a way that allows them to think critically about the candidates' promises and policy proposals from the government.
What would you say to some of the policies which have been put into place, which the way it's reported uncritically is that everything's great? Well, I'll give you one example. A lot of times this happens in the medical world, like, what was it, $25 or $35 insulin? You're not going to have to pay any more than that. You know, you've heard those kind of policies that have been put in place, and people will walk around and brag about it. Hey, I did this, you know, that kind of thing. What are the unseen consequences or untalked about consequences of these kind of programs, which sound really good? And, of course, a lot of people like it because it benefits them personally.
One of the most important unseen consequences of any sort of expansion of the size and scope of government is the inflation tax. So the government realizes that raising taxes is unpopular. I mean, when was the last time you heard a presidential candidate run on raising taxes broadly? Like, everybody's going to have an increase in taxes. And so the politicians realize this. And so what that means is they know that they can achieve all of this spending. So they can give all the subsidies. They can do all these regulations. They can start all these new agencies and programs. They realize they can still do this because they have the power to increase the money supply. They have the power to increase the number of U.S. dollars in existence, and they can spend them into the economy. And what people need to realize, one of the unintended consequences, as you mentioned, is that causes the purchasing power of their dollar to decrease. That means that they have to pay higher prices at the grocery store, at the gas station. All their bills are going to increase as well. And so it's harder for people to connect that to government policies because it's sort of a delayed response. It requires, you know, some deeper level critical thinking. You have to understand the process of inflation to sort of see that happening, and so that's one of the most important unintended consequences of government spending that I try to emphasize in my own work, is so that people will realize that, you know, we can't get something for nothing. There's no such thing as a free gift from the government. Whenever the government is giving you anything, it means that they're taking something away, and whether that's taxes or inflation, it's still harmful to the private sector.
Is there any real way to end the Fed? I remember that was something that Ron Paul, when he was running for president a number of years ago, Dr. Newman, that he was saying, you know, that was one of the things he wanted to do. He wanted to audit the Fed, I think, is what he wanted to do right now. But we have been so used to, well, the government controls the money supply. Well, the government is able to just print currency into existence and then tax you to do the social engineering on the backside, you know, of things. And so is there any real way to get rid of that at this point, or is this just an evil we're going to have to put up with?
Yeah, I'm not sure about the political, you know, the practical side of this, like what would actually have to occur for the Fed to be done away with. It would have to be an act of Congress, because Congress is the one that set up the Fed in the first place. So, you know, we can talk about that if you'd like. But in terms of, like, is it economically feasible? And I would say absolutely yes. It is. We would survive the ending of the Federal Reserve. Not only would we survive, we would thrive. And for me to be able to say that confidently, it's because I understand what the Fed does. What does the Fed do? The Fed controls interest rates. The Fed manipulates the money supply. The Fed gives all of the money that the Treasury wants in the form of buying its debt. And so what that means is the Fed is basically, it's sort of like the shell game. The Fed is the agency that's used by the government to expropriate real resources from the private sector. And so if we got rid of the Fed, we would return to sound money. We would have to return to a money that's selected by the market. What sort of money do the people want? And that might be gold. That might be some sort of cryptocurrency. That might be some other form of money that we haven't even considered. But the point is, if we had a money like that, then it would not be susceptible to increases in supply based on political whim. The supply would be constrained by the cost of production. We would get the exact amount of money that the market demands and that the market can bear. And so what that means is that would be a huge constraint on the government. If they didn't have the ability to inflate the money supply, the amount that the government could spend would be severely constrained. It would be limited by taxes and what it could borrow. But even its borrowing would be limited if it didn't have this, you know, this backstop of the Fed as a ready buyer of its debt.
That's a really interesting way of looking at this. I just know that as we were getting ready for the interest rate cut announcement from the Fed, that's all the markets cared about. That was it. And I had this realization, and it was kind of a sick realization, that there is no market. The only market is what the Fed says the market is at this point. And does this mean we're kind of into a neo-feudalism kind of a situation right now, where you have the people that are into the speculative assets that are pushed by the Federal Reserve or backstopped by the Federal Reserve? You know, they're happy, and all the rest of us are just kind of, you know, working on the Federal Reserve plantation. Is it that bad at this point, really, when you look at it?
What you're hitting on there is the concept of the Fed is a big player. There's a great economist by the name of Roger Koppel who has written a book on how you can get these big players that emerge in the economy, and he even talks about the Fed being a big player. And you're absolutely right. If you look at all the financial news reporting, the way they frame it, and I think it's appropriate framing for what it is everything rides on the Fed's decision. Everybody's looking at the Federal Open Market Committee and their decision to increase interest rates, lower interest rates. What are they going to do to bank reserves? What are they going to do with all these decisions regarding manipulating the interest rate and manipulating the money supply? And what that means is there's a ton of money to be made just by anticipating what the Fed will do. There's a ton of money to be made or lose simply based on the Federal Open Market Committee's decisions. And so let's contrast that with what would prevail in an unhampered market economy. So what if we didn't have a Fed? What would guide people's investment decisions? And of course, the answer is expected profitability. They would understand, you know, some companies are going to do well at anticipating consumer demands. Other companies are not going to do well. Some companies are going to invent new technologies that makes production more efficient. Other companies are not going to do that. And so that's going to guide their investment decisions. What we have now is investment that's simply based on a money spigot. It's investment that's based on low interest rates, investment that's based on tons and tons of new money being funneled into credit markets and into the financial sector, as opposed to like real profitability, as opposed to production for what consumers demand. So the reason the financial news media reports it that way is because it's absolutely true. Everybody's looking at the Fed. Everybody's trying to get their bucket under the money spigot, whereas in a healthy market economy, what we would have is profit and loss driving those decisions.
Yeah, profit and loss, and that's about it. Well, I can give you another example that what the Fed does is essentially crushing savings for the most part, except for a little bit over the last few months of higher interest rates. It was not that long ago in which people could actually retire quite comfortably just by storing their money in CDs and long-term savings rather than having to speculate in something which could go to zero. And yet, because of the Fed, haven't we all been forced that, hey, you either play the stock market or you're screwed, right?
You're exactly right. So we can look at some hyperinflation episodes. So like you look at the Weimar Republic or you look at Zimbabwe. What were people doing during this hyperinflation when the government was printing up, you know, trillions, you know, astronomical numbers in terms of increases in the money supply? People, as soon as they would get paid in that money, they would try to spend it as soon as possible. They would try to convert the money that they had received into some real asset, whether it's goods and services for the home or, you know, buying some land or something like that. There's this strong incentive when your money is losing purchasing power. When prices are rising, there's this strong incentive to not save. The incentive is to spend as much as you can and as fast as you can. And of course, you know, we don't have a hyperinflation right now in the United States, although we did have, you know, a bout of severe inflation over the past few years. But the effect is the exact same. The effect is, you know, they don't have the incentive to save. They see prices are rising, including in stock markets, including for the prices of land and real estate. And so you're exactly right. People, they are forced to speculate. They're forced to put their savings into these speculative vehicles and financial assets, as opposed to just, you know, saving money, as opposed to, you know, setting aside money for retirement or for a rainy day in the future.
Is this
there's
something?
No reason.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead and complete the thought. I didn't mean to interrupt.
Oh, sure. Yeah. There's no reason to set aside money. There's no reason to save money. If you expect that money to lose purchasing power, like why would I set aside $100 today if I know that $100 is going to be worthless in, you know, a year's time or 10 years time? And so that's exactly what we've seen over the past few decades, especially in the United States.
Lessons for the Young Economist is the textbook that that of course you are hoping that will be used. It's already used a lot in homeschooling. Which is another reason why so many of the homeschool kids are coming out smarter, I think, about such matters. And do you believe here, Dr. Newman, by the way, Dr. Jonathan Newman, once again, he's a fellow at the Mises Institute, it's who I'm speaking with this morning. Do you think that that Americans can rekindle that desire to actually truly have a free economy? Because we haven't had a free economy in our lifetimes, have we? Really had a free economy?
I think you're right. What it will take for us to have this sort of rekindled appreciation for economics and sound economics is, you know, parents taking education away from the state. It'll take, you know, voters taking education away from the state. And people are already doing that massively. I mean, there's a huge numbers of people that are deciding to homeschool these days and also go to private schools. If you look at the statistics, there's been a huge, I think, like since the 1970s, the numbers that I was looking at was like almost by a factor of 240 in terms of the homeschooling population in the United States, which that's just a huge growth. And of course, during the COVID regime, during all the lockdowns, there was another surge in the popularity of homeschooling. And that's exactly what we need. We need to get the state out of education. That's not the state's role. And of course, you can imagine what would the state do if they had control of education? Like, just think about it as a hypothetical. They're going to
They're going to make you love and worship the state. That's what they're going to do.
Exactly. They're going to promote narratives that are in favor of the state. They're going to create, you know, loyal citizens that are not going to question policy proposals. They're going to create citizens and voters that are sort of tolerant of price controls, tolerant of inflation. They're not going to appreciate the beauty and the functioning of the market economy. And so that's what we need. We need students to learn good economics so that they question that and so that they're not, you know, so susceptible to these, you know, really poor economic arguments for state intervention.
Well, to the nonsense that you'll hear all over the campaign trail, no matter what day it is when you tune in, especially the closer you get to elections, the higher the nonsense level goes. Isn't that usually what happens? Generally,
yes, that's exactly right. And one thing that I would point out, like one of the most important lessons that students can learn is the profit and loss mechanism. I know I've already mentioned it a few times before, but what we've seen today among the electorate is this distrust, this skepticism for profits. There are people who think that market prices are just these arbitrary numbers that are set by, you know, corporations that are really greedy, and, you know, the cause of inflation is this like wave of corporate greed that seems to come from nowhere. And so what that means is that they don't understand what market prices are. They don't understand how profit and losses, they regulate the market economy for us. That profits attract producers to come produce more of the things that consumers want. Losses discourage that sort of thing. And consumers, they are the ones who decide whether or not a company is profitable. They're the ones who have final say over, do I want this product that was offered for sale to me by this entrepreneur? And in their decision, they're the ones who are saying, good job, entrepreneur. You economized resources. You didn't waste. You produced something efficiently. You made something that I wanted. And when consumers decide not to buy, that causes the entrepreneur to incur losses, and it means that those resources get moved into profitable production. So there's a very important mechanism at play here, and it's not just like a corporate greed game. It's not just, you know, corporate consolidation is causing, you know, greedy CEOs to hike their prices. What we need is a healthy appreciation for market prices and for the profit and loss system, and that I think that would go to tremendous lengths in solving many, many problems in the United States today.
Don't you find it interesting that nobody accuses Apple of price gouging when it releases a new iPhone that people are clamoring for and waxing poetic over? But then you have people that are saying that the grocery stores are accused of, Kamala Harris would say, price gouging, you know, that kind of thing, or price gouging. And they're sitting there with like a 1 or 2% profit margin overall, which is really not that much in the grand scheme of things. What isn't the Apple 10 to 15, 20% in some cases on iPhones, you know, that sort of thing?
I wouldn't be surprised if that's the case. But you're absolutely right about the profit margins for grocery stores. I don't even understand. It's hard for me to get into the heads of some of these people who are maligning grocery stores as if like this is the source of all the ills for the consumer these days. As if like the grocery store is just like arbitrarily increasing prices. Like, do they not? I guess if you did like a man on the street sort of interview and you asked people, what sort of profit margins do you think grocery stores get? They would probably see something like, I don't know, 20, 30, maybe even higher than 50% based on the propaganda that they've been fed. But it's just hogwash. It's nonsense. Their profit margins are low. Of course, I mean, there was like a tiny increase in their profit margins as a result of all the what was going on during the COVID pandemic. But no, it went from like 1.6 to 3%. You know, it's like even that is just tiny. That's not alarming. That's not something that would, you know, set off alarm bells where people's like, oh, no, what's going on with the grocery stores?
Well, yeah, but in fact, it's a
natural response.
In fact, that's a very tight profit margin in the world. That's a tough business, in other words, is what I'm saying. You have to be really, really smart to be able to make it in groceries because it's not easy, is it?
You're exactly right. And I'll tell you the reason why they're trying to put the blame on grocery stores. It's because they need a scapegoat. It's because they need to direct people's anger, their correct anger, their righteous anger over higher prices. They're trying to direct their anger towards grocery store owners, towards, you know, something as amorphous and vague as corporate greed, as opposed to the true source of inflation, which is increasing the money supply. It's all of the government spending. It's all of the, you know, the handouts that happened during COVID. All of that is what causes prices to rise. It's their propaganda is aimed at trying to get people to not blame the government, not blame the Federal Reserve, but instead blame, you know, the most proximate person to the higher price, which is, you know, the grocery store. But, you know, when you do that, when you try to employ that sort of propaganda, you're really revealing how stupid you think the Americans are. You're saying, I think I can deflect the blame. I think, you know, they see the grocery store is increasing the price. I'll get them to blame, you know, those people as opposed to the people who are, you know, dumping trillions and trillions of dollars into the economy.
Yeah. You know something, Dr. Newman, I would say something else that would be helpful is that it would help Americans to be better at mathematics. Make mathematics great again. Would also help make economics great again. Wouldn't you agree on that? Because when you start talking about big numbers, most of us are kind of innumerate on such matters and have great difficulty conceptualizing it. That's maybe just the human condition. I don't know. Any thoughts on that?
I think you're right. I think one of the things that has helped the propaganda from the state in recent years is the fact that it's really hard for us to conceptualize billions and trillions of dollars. Like, you know, we see a headline that the money supply increased by $6 trillion over, you know, a few months or over a couple of years. And it's really hard for people to sort of understand. It's hard for people to, you know, make sense of that. And so, like, just the sheer size of numbers makes it easier for the government to say, yeah, well, you know, we've got this billion-dollar project here, we've got this $100 billion project here, or we're sending this many billions of dollars to this country and this many billions of dollars to this country. And so it's hard for people to sort of think about, you know, what is the government's budget? How should we think about the government's budget? And so, yeah, a little bit of, you know, mathematical aptitude would be good along those lines.
Indeed. Dr. Jonathan Newman is a fellow at the Mises Institute. He passed his math classes. And he, of course, promoting the book Lessons for the Young Economist, which is a textbook that they're trying to get into the schools. And I also wanted to mention that you had a couple of books that you wrote, some children's books. And I think this is trying to help people understand, little kids understand economics. And what were those two books?
Yeah, the first one was based on the broken window parable. So the title of the book is The Broken Window. And that was just my attempt at, you know, taking this nice little story that was presented by an economist from the mid-1800s by the name of Frederick Bastiat. And then the parable was popularized by Henry Hazlitt in his book, Economics in One Lesson. And it's just a great little parable, and it's a little story that I thought children could grasp, and so I thought I would get somebody to illustrate the story, and I would tell it in a way that rhymes, and this would be something that parents could use to teach their kids economic lessons. Would you like me to go through the parable really quickly?
Oh, sure. Go ahead. You bet.
So the parable goes this way. A young kid throws a brick through a baker's window, and a crowd gathers to look at this event and try to make sense of it. And the first conclusion that they draw is that this would be good for the economy, because now the baker has to spend some money so that he can, you know, pay the glass repair guy to fix the broken pane of glass. And so the crowd concludes now the glass repair business has some extra money that they can use to spend. And so this broken window is actually beneficial for our economy because it stimulates spending and employment. But then the economist arrives on the scene and corrects the crowd and allows them to, or points them to the counterfactual, points them to the opportunity cost, which is that if the baker didn't have to spend money on repairing the broken pane of glass, the baker would have spent money on a new pair of shoes or a new suit, perhaps.
Or maybe he had invested into a better better oven to be able to expand the bakery. There's all sorts of ways.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
Exactly right. So the destruction did not increase spending or employment. All it did was redirect it. All it did was destroy resources and redirect who is getting employed and who is getting the money in terms of spending. And so this is an important lesson because it gets students to understand the concept of opportunity cost. Like, you can't get something for nothing. Like, you can't just go around destroying resources and expect the economy to grow as a result.
Well, as an example, if you hear anybody talking about, hey, the economy is going to be stimulated by the hurricane destruction of North Carolina because they'll have to rebuild all of this, you smack them upside the head, right?
You're exactly right. We see this sort of journalism all the time after a hurricane or a tornado or an earthquake. Some journalists will write an article. They'll say, you know, it's not all bad news. because all this destruction means that they're going to have to spend money to repair the buildings and fix all the infrastructure. But of course, that's ignoring the opportunity cost. It's ignoring what the people would have spent their money on if they didn't have to repair all of the buildings and repair all of the infrastructure. They could have, you know, sent their kids to better schools. They could have gone on more vacations. They could have, you know, bought better and higher quality food, you know. So the fact that there's all of this spending that seems to be conjured up by destruction, it doesn't mean that it's new employment. It doesn't mean that it's beneficial for the economy. In fact, it's very harmful. It's destructive of real resources.
Dr. Jonathan Newman, fellow at the Mises Institute, Mises, MISES.org. And is there anything else that we should know about how people can get in touch with you and check out what's going on with everything you're thinking?
I highly recommend your listeners go to our website, Mises.org, MISES.org. Mm-hmm. We've got tons and tons of resources, libraries full of resources that are available for free for everybody to read and enjoy. And we have podcasts as well. And, of course, if people want to follow me on Twitter, I'm there as well.
Doctor, a pleasure meeting and talking with you. And thanks for the economic lessons, okay? Be well.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
And more importantly, be profitable, right? Be profitable and economically sound.